Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Duchenne. I'm the Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you this morning to this lecture by Professor John Rigdon, his third lecture at Einstein Fest. We're delighted that John has joined us for the weekend and has done such a marvelous job for us so far in his first two lectures. And just a reminder to all of you that he, in fact, joins us for a fifth time for Bistro Banter this afternoon in the Bistro, our informal series of talks, discussions, debates, Q&A with our host, Howard Burton, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute. John Rigdon is Honorary Professor of Physics at Washington University in St. Louis, author of numerous books, including most recently the critically acclaimed Einstein 1905, The Standard of Greatness, a wonderful book about the 1905 papers that John wrote. He received his BS from Eastern Nazarene College and his PhD from Johns Hopkins University. Upon completion of his graduate work, he was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University. He has served on the faculties of Eastern Nazarene College, Middlebury College, and the University of Missouri, St. Louis. In 1987, John Rigdon joined the American Institute of Physics, where he served as director of physics programs. He was editor of the American Journal of Physics from 1975 to 1985. In 1992, he was a director of development of the National Science Standards Project at the Academy of Sciences. And in 1995, he was elected chairman of the History of Physics Forum of the American Physical Society. John Rigdon is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the American Physical Society, and he holds an honorary Doctor of Science degree from Denison University. We are very pleased to have John Rigdon with us. Please welcome him.
Thank you very much. It's been good fun. Probably the most, this is 2005. You all know that? 2005? And what we're celebrating here in 2005 is the centennial of Einstein's great year. I'm sure you all know that. It was that year, 1905, when in 6 months, 1 week, and 2 days, Einstein wrote five very important papers. So it was an accomplishment that has no comparison in the history of physics. Newton wrote the Principia in 3 years. Very most important book of science, of physics. But Einstein's 6 months stands alone. But his greatest paper, single paper, was in 1915. And that was the general theory of relativity. He spent the better part of 10 years in sustained, focused concentration, trying to develop what he had in his mind. It was a tough job. Anybody here? I don't see many young folks, but I will say to any of you, what you lack in native ability, really, a lot of that can be made up in hard work. One of the things Einstein was capable of doing, as was Newton, as were all great scientists, is their ability to really focus and concentrate for endless weeks on one thing. And they solved it. Often, they solved it. Well, after general relativity came out, a prediction was made, and 4 years later, the prediction was shown to be true. And it was an amazing thing. I'll talk about it maybe later, probably this afternoon. But when Einstein was told that his prediction had been proven true, he didn't show much excitement. And his assistant, Elsa Rosenthal Schneider, said, "Why aren't you excited?" And Einstein replied, "I knew the theory was true." And Elsa said, "But what What if your prediction had been refuted? Einstein responded, "Then I would feel sorry for God because the theory is true." Now, some of you, I don't know, some of you might call that arrogance. It could have been a touch of arrogance. I see it, as I understand Einstein from this point, I see it as a symptom of his confidence. Einstein was supremely confident about his own work. When everyone was ridiculing him about his particle theory of light, which was the March paper. By the way, today we're going to talk about the April-May papers. They go together. The March paper proposed that light consists of particles. Everybody ridiculed him. They thought he had slipped a cog and had gone over the edge. 1915, he wrote a letter to his friend Michel Bessel and said, "The light quantum is practically certain." 11 years of ridicule, 11 years of rejection. Einstein was very confident that that idea had absolute validity. And of course, 1923-24, that prediction or that idea of light consisting of particles was demonstrated in very convincing ways. And today, Einstein's light particle is part of physics. Now, what I want to ask is, why was Einstein so confident? Well, the way he approached his physics was different than Lotz. Einstein said, I want to know how God created the universe, the world. I want to know, God, look at that slide. I hate slides. I want to know God's thoughts. The rest are details. You'll have to go without the K over here. Now, in another time, he said, what I'm really interested in is whether God could have made the world in a different way. That is, whether the necessity of simplicity leaves any freedom at all. In other words, did God have any freedom in creating the world if simplicity was a criterion? And for Einstein, simplicity was a criterion. You don't seek explanations that are inherently so complicated you can hardly understand them. You want simple explanations. So Einstein approached his physics through the mental attitude of seeking God's thoughts, which immediately puts him on a plane of importance, of fundamental approach to knowledge. You're not out there counting acorns when you're seeking God's thoughts. You're trying to understand nature at the most profound level. And because Einstein worked at the level of fundamentals, and because he was able to connect his developing ideas with the fundamentals of physics in such a way that if his ideas were wrong, then a lot of other physics was wrong. A lot of the fundamentals of physics was wrong, and he did not believe that. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that the laws of physics that we have lived with, that they're valid, they hold up. And Einstein was confident about a lot of the laws of physics. And since his ideas were connected to those fundamental ideas of physics, the basic laws of basic sort, he had confidence that his ideas had to be right. So his approach to nature was very profound. And this left him with a great sense of confidence. He worked alone, so he didn't have any collaborator screwing things up. If something was wrong, he basically only had himself to blame, and he worked very carefully. He made mistakes, but he was confident. And the principal tool of his work was his mind, his brain. Some physicists work from data. They take a set of data and they try to explain it. Einstein created ideas, new ideas. And sometimes he had data, but mostly. Einstein's papers had very few citations. Very few. He has been criticized for that. There are scholars who think he could have cited so-and-so and so-and-so and so, but he did not. Part of the reason was Einstein was unknown and worked in the Burns Patent Office, was outside the physics community, did not have the privilege of talking to colleagues, and really had little access to libraries. In fact, he was asked to write a review article in about 1908 or 9, and he told Zeeman that, you know, he really couldn't get to a library to look at the literature to see what had happened so he could review this particular field. So Einstein's confidence was born, I think, of his unique, more or less, you know, I don't like unique, of his unusual approach to physics. So that's where I start today, just to remind you that. And now let's remember where we are, just to give a little bit of background, and some of you have been here earlier, but 19th century physics produced an enormous amount of new knowledge. And I'll just say the whole theory and nature of light was determined and completed. Electromagnetism was brought to completion, essential completion, so that everything electrical and magnetic was understood. Thermodynamics, the way matter, material objects respond to temperature and heat, that thing was brought to completion. The kinetic theory of matter, the fact that matter consists of atoms, and these atoms are typically in a gas, for example, are in random motion. That was worked through with wonderful detail so that people could predict things from the kinetic theory of matter. Then the whole idea of light and how it gets from place to place, the ether was created and the ether carried the light. And then that was pretty much done. All right. It should not be surprising with all that was done from, say, 19th century, that there would be some problems as you come into the 20th century. And when Einstein appeared on the scene, his first paper was in 1901, so you might say his professional career began around 1901. Well, there was a virtual banquet table set with a range of dishes that physicists could look at and partake of, and these dishes represent, for me, problems. And so you stand around the banquet table and you try to decide which problem am I going to look at and try to resolve. Well, Einstein was one of the people there, and here are the dishes, and you can see from the words I have used, the dishes involve the very things that came out of 19th century physics, thermodynamics and kinetic theory, mechanics. Mechanics, by the way, was brought to completion in the 18th century. It was essentially complete by the 19th century. A few little refinements. But thermodynamics, kinetic theory, electromagnetism, these were all creations of the 19th century. And because they were put together so well and so quickly, individually they seemed all right. But when you brought together thermodynamics and kinetic theory and tried to make sure they blended properly, they didn't. And I've likened it to, you know, you add flour to meat sauce to thicken it a bit and have a nice smooth gravy. Well, sometimes the damn flour lumps, and, you know, the gravy's not so hot. Well, these were lumpy dishes, and there were problems, all right? And what every one of these dishes, Einstein addressed and resolved. Every one of them. Profound things. The light and atoms. That was the March paper. We talked about that yesterday. Today, we are going to talk about, I'll say dish two and dish three in that lineup of five. We're going to talk about thermodynamics and kinetic theory, and as you can read. Okay, now, what is the issue in that first dish? What are the lumps? Why, when you put kinetic theory and thermodynamics together, were there lumps? Thermodynamics deals with how material objects respond to thermal influences, heat, temperature, and so forth. And there are two wonderful laws in the 19th century and when Einstein was working. The first law is essentially a statement of the conservation of energy. Energy was a concept brought to completion in the 19th century, one of the most powerful ideas in all of science. The conservation of energy applies to physics, chemistry, biology, geology, the whole schmear. It appears in many different forms, and they can transform from one form to another as you're watching, as you watch an object fall. Potential energy is being transformed into kinetic energy as it speeds up towards the ground. No energy is lost. When the object is falling, we're not losing energy, we're not gaining energy, we're merely transforming from one kind to another. But you look at the whole world, the energy in the universe is a constant. It doesn't change. None is lost. And I'm thinking, you know, dark energy, is that? That's not new energy, is it? We don't know, do we? We don't know. Look, there's some funny things going on. The world is strange, all right? And so we're keeping at it, and we're learning all the time. But as far as we know right now, and for the last 150 years, the energy is conserved. It never loses nor gains. Okay, that's the first law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics has to do with another concept called entropy, and it's a beautiful concept. It's mysterious, and you can think of it in different ways. But you can express the second law of thermodynamics by simply saying that in every process you observe, the entropy increases. Now, you, as a person, can get into a system and input energy into that system and make the entropy go less, go from high to low. You can force the entropy to decrease. But if you leave nature alone and just watch it, then everything you see, the entropy is increasing. All right? Now I want to give an example of that and set the stage for what Einstein did. I want you to imagine a box of dye. A dye is one half of dice. Dye is kind of a funny word in a way. Think of a box of dye. Yes, think of that, but before you come back to me a minute, don't think. We say correctly that the entropy increases. A man by the name of Ludwig Boltzmann came along towards the end of the 19th century and connected entropy with probability, order and disorder. An ordered system, ordered, is a low probability state. When everything is in its place, there's only one way that can happen, one way. There's any number of ways that things can be out of their place. That's a high probability state, okay? And I'm going to get back to this. In fact, right now, let's look at dye, this box of dice. Come back to me. Take one die in a box. Turn it so the six is up. You look at it, there's the six. Put the cover on, shake the box. What's the likelihood that you'll see a six when you open the box? What's the likelihood? Now, come on, you guys, some of you play the lottery. You know how to do these things. Likelihood is 1 in 6. 1 in 6. There's 6 sides, so 1/6. You have 1 chance out of 6 that'll be a 6. Let's put 2 die in. Put them up, face up. By the way, when there's 1 die in there, you can't say that something is ordered or disordered. I mean, it doesn't make sense with 1 die. All right. Put 2 die in. Turn them both up to 6. That's an ordered state. And it's not very probable. Shake the box, and what is the likelihood of seeing 2 sixes after you've shaken it? What? No. That's 1 in 36. 1 in 36. So you see, there are 36 ways those 2 die can face when you open the box, can be facing 36 ways, and you only have 1 chance out of 36 to have 2 sixes. That's an ordered system, 2 sixes showing. Now let's go on and keep this up just a bit. Suppose, and I'm going to show you this, suppose you have 6 die. If you shake the box, there's only 1 chance out of 46,656 that they'll all be facing 6 up. Not much of a chance. You see, it's much more likely that that system of 6 die will be a random range, you know, a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4, so forth, all right? To have all 6 show up 6 is a highly ordered system. Now go to 30 die. 1 chance in 221,000 billion billion. Go to 120 die. 120, you could go in there and in 10 minutes you could put every die with 6 up. That's an ordered system. All sixes. Shake it. What is the chance of there being all sixes? 120? 1 chance in 2,389 billion, 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 10 times. 10 billion, 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 10 times. You say it, I'm not going to. What does this mean? This means if you could shake it and look at it once a second. Once a second, all right? It would take you 76,000 billion, 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 9 times years to shake it that many times, all right? And if all people on the globe, 6 billion of them, were given a box of dye and they each shook for 1 time per second, you'd have to shake it. And remember now, you're going to have to shake it, what did I say, 2,389 billion, 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 10 times. That's the odds against getting all sixes. So on average, you'd have to shake it that many times. Let's go back to make sure you understand this. 2 die, on average, you'd have to shake it 36 times to get both sixes. On average. 120 die, there's the big number. And if all people in the world have a box of die, it would take 12,600 billion, 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 8 times years before probability would suggest you could get one example of all sixes. Now, this is what probability is about. You know what it is about? People tell you, you buy a ticket for the lottery and you have 1 chance in 20 million of winning. Well, you know, that's not a very good chance, all right? There's a lesson here. The lesson is that as the number of die increase, you see that the numbers get big very fast. From 1 in 6 to 1 in 36 and so on. Now, when you take the number of atoms in a system, take this room. This room has oxygen and nitrogen molecules, and you're sitting there inhaling. What is the probability that all of these oxygen and nitrogen molecules would migrate to this side of the room, and all you poor suckers would be gasping for breath? Okay? Now, I will tell you, if there were 10 molecules in this room, then the probability of all 10 being on this side at any moment would be quite high. I mean, that would happen several times a day. All 10 molecules on this side. 10. And even if there were 100 in this room, that would happen from time to time, but not very often. But if we have this room as it is now, with zillions and zillions, you know, I mean, look, these numbers look big. They looked big until Bush came along and with his deficits, you know. These numbers look pretty puny. But here, the molecules in this room, there are so many of them. I mean, the atoms and molecules in this room, I mean, I said 120 die. The number of atoms in this room is just enormous. And think of the highly ordered system it would be if you would take all of the atoms in this room and bring them over to one side. That's much more ordered than having them distributed throughout. That's a very, very, it's ordered, but very unlikely that that would ever happen. All right, now this is all background. Okay, now this is background to dish number 3. I want to give some background to dish number 2. And if you remember, dish number 3, is that right? Yes, 3, is mechanics, thermodynamics, and kinetic theory. What is the issue here? Well, to let you know that this was an important issue in 1900, here's a quote: "The most important question perhaps of contemporary scientific philosophy is that of the compatibility of thermodynamics and mechanism." By thermodynamics and mechanism, they're referring to mechanics, thermodynamics and mechanics, all right? So this was a real issue when Einstein, what was the issue? The issue was this, that if you look at the molecules in this room, or take it simple, you look at the balls on a pool table, and you smash the balls and they go different directions and so forth. No, that's not a good example. I don't want that example. Erase that. I'm just going to say this. If you look at, well, look, here it is. Remember, there was also kinetic theory in there, right? I should have said this. The lumps were mechanics, thermodynamics, and kinetic theory. All right, what is the issue? Kinetic theory says that these atoms and molecules are moving in random fashion, colliding with each other, colliding with the sides of the vessel, colliding and so forth. Random. Now, in addition, these moving molecules obey Newton's laws of mechanics. They obey those laws. They're consistent with Newton. Now, here comes the rub. You look at those colliding molecules. Take a movie of them. Everything looks fine. Run the movie backwards. Everything looks fine. You can't tell. As far as mechanics, as far as Newton is concerned, time can go forwards or backwards. Mechanical processes are reversible. All right? But in thermodynamics, you see, here you have this kinetic theory entering because the mechanics of the molecules are such that time is reversible, backwards, forwards. Now you come to thermodynamics, and thermodynamics is irreversible. I could bring a big piston in this room and push all the air in this room over to this side. And then I could open a little window, and what would happen? The air would stream out the window, fill this side, until the pressure on this side, the pressure on this side, on pretty much on average, the number of molecules on this side, the number of air molecules on this side, they would be the same. And it would never, never go backwards. We would sit here forever, all eternity, and we would never see the molecules on this side stream back through that window and come to this side. That would never happen. Why? Because the probability is just too low. I mean, the probability of that happening is indescribably small. So this was the problem between mechanics and thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is reversible, irreversible. Things go one way. One way. Natural processes. Boulders roll down the side of a hill. You never see them rolling back up. Always that way. And everything you see, you think about it, has direction to it. Well, all right. This is background to these two papers. I can show you. Here is an example of reversibility. No, it's not the example. Here's a collision. You can film this. It's a simple thing. Just two bodies, they collide. But if you film that and then run it backwards, the collision going back the other way is perfectly all right. There's no problem. But here's something. If you have coffee and cream divided, you open the little red window, pretty soon you're going to have a mixture of coffee and cream equally on both sides, and never, ever again will you see all the cream over on the right and the coffee on the, you'll never see it. This is reversible. This is irreversible. Open the window. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. All right. Now, these two papers, April and May, notice, by the way, he finished paper number two, April 30th. That's the last day, or no, April, 3 days have September, April. That's the last day of April. 10 days later, 10 lousy days, he turned in this great paper on Brownian motion. Man, that guy was really, he was really making it, wasn't he? Well, all right, what is it? Now, it turns out that his April paper was his dissertation. And I'm going to spend just a few minutes on his dissertation because it's almost comical. I mean, Einstein started out with a thesis advisor called Heinrich Frederick Weber, Polytechnic in Zurich. And he had Weber as a professor, and Weber was not very interesting, and Weber and Einstein started skipping class, and the teacher, Professor Weber, noticed and took offense at it. But Einstein came up with a wonderful idea in 1899, to measure the speed of light relative to the ether. Now, he had not heard of the Michelson-Morley experiment. We'll get to that this afternoon. But he had this wonderful idea, and Weber rejected that idea out of hand. It could have been a great experiment. All right. In 1899, the same year, the electron was brand new. And Einstein came to Weber with another idea. Weber brushed that off and wouldn't accept it. So far, no luck. So he switched from Weber to Alfred Kleiner, another professor. In April 1901, he was planning a dissertation. And he developed it. And in April 14th, 1901, he wrote to his friend Grossmann, Marcel Grossmann. He said, as for science, I have a few splendid ideas. Now, 1901 was just the beginning, for which now only need proper incubation. And by the way, the papers of 1905 were incubating in 1901. All right. So he proposes a dissertation to Kleiner, and I want you to notice the pattern here. All of the ideas are coming from Einstein. Typically, you know, the professor makes some suggestions. I want you to do this, I want you to do that. Einstein was telling the professor what he wants to do. Well, in November of 1901, Einstein submits a dissertation. On November 3rd, he writes his girlfriend, Maliva, that he has written a magnificent study and submitted it as a dissertation. On November 28th, later that month, he writes Maliva, "So far, I have no report from Kleiner. I don't think he would dare to reject my dissertation. But otherwise, in my opinion, there is nothing that can be done with that short-sighted man." On December 12th, he writes to his girlfriend, Maliva, "It should be noted that Kleiner hasn't written yet." On December 17th, 1901, again to Maliva, "Since that bore, Kleiner, hasn't answered yet, I am going to take him to task on Thursday." And it's December 19th, writes to Maliva, "He, Kleiner, hasn't read the thesis yet." January 22nd, he writes to his friend, Michel Besseau, "I will not go for a doctorate because it would be of little help to me and the whole comedy has become boring." That thesis was lost that he had handed in to Kleiner. No one knows what happened to it. Okay, now the next step in this document is not well documented with independent sources, but his sister, Maya, says that in early 1905, he submitted a dissertation to Kleiner, an early version of the theory of relativity. That was rejected, and she, Maya, says it was because the professors couldn't understand it. So that was rejected. So what you're seeing is there's a whole pattern of rejection and problems. This is Albert Einstein, folks. Any of you that are going to school and having problems, you know, don't worry. Albert Einstein had problems too. And finally, in April of 1905, he wrote a dissertation, which he submitted. It was returned because it was too short. Einstein added one sentence and turned it back in, and it was accepted. I mean, Einstein, you can still hear him laughing if you listen hard. So he had his eye, but this is not the end of it. There's a couple chapters yet, and it wasn't until 1911, this is 1905, it wasn't until 1911 that all of his dissertation problems were finally behind him. All right. Einstein's dissertation had to do with a way of determining the dimensions of a sugar molecule. I want you to know, by the way, there's a background here. And the background is that there are a number of people, who did not believe in the reality of atoms. They rejected the idea of atoms. So, all right, here is what happens in April and May. In April, Einstein develops a way to determine the dimensions of a sugar molecule, a little tiny sugar molecule. In May, he works with a pollen particle, which is much, much bigger. All right. What he did to determine the sugar molecule dimensions. And by the way, Einstein was an atomist. He believed in atoms. And part of his strategy for this dissertation was that he wanted to lend credence and give further evidence for the reality of atoms. And he also wanted to support Boltzmann's probabilistic way of looking at thermodynamic things. So, all right, in his April paper on sugar molecules, what he did was he played against each other two things. If I open up a bottle of very aromatic and really nice smelling perfume, right here, this is a highly ordered system. All the perfume molecules are right here, but it's highly aromatic and volatile. So a few molecules start coming out the bottle, and pretty soon you can smell it. You can get a little whiff, and you know you're smelling perfume pretty soon. You know you're smelling perfume pretty soon. You know. So going from all the molecules right around the bottle, they diffuse until they're equally spread through this room. And the bottle is empty. We go from a low entropy ordered system, all the perfume molecules together, to a highly high entropy state where all the perfume molecules are distributed throughout the room. All right? Now, in order to do that, this is called diffusion. The perfume molecules diffuse through the air molecules. But they can't do that freely. I mean, there is what is called viscosity. And so the perfume molecules sort of have to, you know, sort of have to make their way through the air molecules, and the air molecules are banging against them. And, you know, so there's these two opposing forces of viscosity opposing the diffusion, and the diffusion trying to increase the hell out of entropy, all right? So they're trying to get everything everywhere, he played these two things together in his dissertation, and he was able to compute the dimensions of a sugar molecule as well as the numerical value of Avogadro's number, which was not known well at that time. So that's now number April. That's basically April. I want to go quickly to the May paper. And here in the May paper, now remember what the issue is. The issue is, maybe I didn't say it clearly, thermodynamics and kinetic theory. When you have thermodynamics with its roots in matter, it makes no assumption about the nature of matter. But if matter consists of atoms in random motion, then the question is, can the laws of thermodynamics be violated? Go back to the dice. What did I say? 120 dice. Is that what I said? 120 dice in the box. Shake them. They won't be all sixes. But you go over here in one part of the box, and you may see three sixes right beside each other. 120 die, and you'll see three sixes. Or over here, you'll see three threes. That's not normal. That won't happen all the time, but that's a statistical fluctuation. Where three sixes come up right together. Won't happen often, but it does. So the question is, can the atoms and molecules of matter in their random motion be such that the laws of thermodynamics are violated and in regions throughout the material system? If so, then that means the laws of thermodynamics are not absolute. They're true only in a statistical sense. All right? Many people rejected this idea, and that's partly why they rejected atoms. They didn't want matter to be consistent of atoms with randomness, because that would render thermodynamics statistical rather than absolute. So, all right. Now, here it is in the first paper. Oh, no, just a minute. I'm in the wrong slide here, I believe. Let me get back. I've told you before, I don't like slides. Yes, here it is. I want you just to read that. I'll read it out loud. This is the beginning paragraph of his May paper on Brownian motion. If it is really possible to observe the motion to be discussed here, then classical thermodynamics can no longer be reviewed as strictly valid, even for microscopically distinguishable spaces. I mean, look, what he's saying is you can look at spaces visible through a microscope, and in those microscopically visible spaces, thermodynamics will be violated. So, and an exact determination of the real sizes of atoms become possible. Conversely, if the prediction of this motion were to be proved wrong, this fact would provide a weighty argument against the molecular kinetic conception of heat. So hanging in the balance is either a valid thermodynamics or the kinetic theory. So these two had to be reconciled. All right, now, we come back to, this is the two things, and now the first, this is a paragraph in, and I don't know if you can see that. I think you should just read the red, but I will read it quickly. And this is in his April paper, his dissertation. He's saying a molecule, remember he's looking at a sugar molecule, a molecule would behave approximately as a solid body, suspended in a solvent. And then in the May paper, he says, a dissolved molecule differs from a suspended body in size alone. Now, I want you to think of those two things. Here's a pollen particle 10,000 times bigger than a molecule, than the sugar molecule. And what Einstein has the audacity to say, but he proves it, is that that sugar molecule and that pollen particle behave just the same in the liquid and can be regarded just the same. The only difference is the motion of the pollen particle is much slower than the motions molecule of the molecule of sugar. Now, what is the issue here? The issue here in Brownian motion is that pollen particles were observed by Brown, that's why it's called Brownian, and they went through a motion that was completely random, and it zigged and zagged and went all over through the liquid. You couldn't predict where it was going next. You couldn't predict the next step. It could go in any direction. And how do you explain this? Well, at first they thought that this pollen particle was living and that it had, you know, it was swimming or something. But then they ground up granite and they put fine pieces of granite, and the granite did the same thing. Well, granite's not alive. So clearly the cause was physical, and you had to have some kind of a physical cause to explain it. So Einstein put this pollen particle, or looked at this pollen particle in the liquid, and what he did for the first time was demonstrated that statistical fluctuations actually occur. They actually occur in nature. And what he did was he showed that on average, this pollen particle is bombarded on all sides equally by water molecules. This pollen particle is suspended in water. And so on average, water molecules hit it all sides equally, and the pollen particle is stationary. But every now and then, a whole bunch will hit the left side, many more than the right side, at an instant. And at this instant, the pollen particle is pushed to the left. Is that right, left? No, pushed to the right. Many more molecules are hit the left side, and as a result, the pollen particle is pushed to the right. And then, a moment later, many more particles hit underneath than hit on top, and it's pushed up. And in random fashion, the molecules hit differently, more on this side, more on this side, more. And so the pollen particle responding to this random statistical fluctuation. What is a statistical fluctuation? Can anyone tell me in that picture what is a statistical fluctuation? On average, the same number of molecules are striking that pollen particle on all sides. But every now and then, there's a departure from normal behavior, and you get more molecules hitting one side than the other. That's not normal, but it happens. That's a fluctuation. And that fluctuation occurs all around, hitting it on all different sides of the pollen particle, which I've said then leads to the zigzagging motion. Well, he demonstrated this, and in the process, he clearly demonstrated the fact that thermodynamics was only statistical, that you could look in microscopically visible spaces and the entropy would not be increasing, it would be decreasing, violating the second law of thermodynamics. But it would only be for a short time, but in that little pocket, the law could be violated. He showed that was true, that was possible, okay? Now, one of the things about Einstein's papers, which I'm afraid physicists today, working in string theory and, you know, these Heike-Fluton topics, don't appreciate. They work at it. They don't appreciate it as much as they should, I think. Einstein almost always tied his theoretical ideas, his theoretical predictions, to real experiments that you could perform to test his ideas. All right? He didn't leave it up there just as a grand idea. He told the world how you could test it. All right? And in this case, he told the world how they could test it. And it's pure magic. Now remember, if Einstein's theory is correct, statistical fluctuations exist, the laws of thermodynamics are statistical, and atoms are real. Because what he is observing here, what he showed, is that this big ball of pollen is behaving just like an atom, only more slowly. Because it's so big, it moves more slowly than an atom, than a molecule of water. But he showed that the two are equivalent. So what he gave us was a microscope into the atomic world. And by watching the particle of pollen, we were watching essentially the way water molecules were behaving in the liquid. You couldn't see the water molecules, but you could see the pollen. Now, what do? How are you going to... So he made it, he showed this. But how did he allow us to test his idea? I'll tell you what he did. I'll show you what he did. This is pure magic. Unbelievable. What Einstein did, I want you to look at the left-hand side. There's the pollen particle on the left-hand side. Okay, are you with me? Pollen particle on the left. After a number of zigs and zags and zigs and zags, it's over there on the right. Okay, you with me? Now, the way he developed his theory, all you had to do was identify through the microscope, watching this pollen particle with a grid behind it in some way, note the location of the pollen particle. Go out and have a cup of coffee, come back 12 minutes later, and it's gone from that left position to the right position. Okay? Okay? So with a ruler, you measure that distance, X whatever. And with your wristwatch, you measure the amount of time. With a ruler and a wristwatch, you prove atoms. Holy moly! I mean, it was so beautiful. I mean, it was so simple and so wonderful. Well, you know, of course it was picked up. People in Paris saw, they salivated, you know, they were going to prove atoms. And Perrin in Paris worked through the set up experiments to see. Now, by the way, Einstein had a definite prediction, namely that in a certain amount of, he related the time required to migrate randomly through a certain distance. He gave an equation which said, here is how far it will migrate along the x direction in terms of time. So Perrin could test this absolutely. And of course, it came out wonderfully. And all the skeptics who did not believe in atoms came crawling to Einstein and said, yes, sir, I believe in atoms. This was the last piece of resistance against the idea of atoms. Well, how about mechanics? How does this resolve the problem with mechanics? You know, mechanics is reversible. That collision can go either way. Thermodynamics is irreversible. Well, what Einstein was showing at the same time was that this coffee and cream, once mixed, can indeed unmix. It is reversible. But because he showed that the statistical view of matter is valid, that the probability of unmixing is so small that you would wait several hundred universes, ages of the universe, for that to happen. It can happen. It absolutely can happen. All of those cream molecules can turn around and reverse and go back the same path that they came and get back on the same side and be separated. That can happen. But the likelihood of that happen, forget it. It won't happen. Not in your lifetime. Not in the lifetime of our sun. Not in the lifetime of this universe. It won't happen. So, mechanics and thermodynamics, the lumps are out. Kinetic theory and thermodynamics, the lumps are out. These two now, these big theories blend very nicely. Thermodynamics is statistical. So based on the random motion of atoms, everything is fine. It's been shown that it is statistical. The problem is over. Mechanics and thermodynamics, and reversibility is there, but when looked at in terms of probability, certain things just will never happen. So these wonderful papers were done, and it made a big difference. By the way, the Brownian motion paper has had lots of applications in different things. His dissertation is one of his most cited papers. Do you know why? Because it has many applications, the size of a sugar molecule. It's used, his ideas, this, what he did in that paper is used to analyze mother's milk, cement, all colloidal solutions, and industries use it for different things. So here's, it's an unusual paper. His dissertation is much more mathematical than his typical papers, which, by the way, is one reason given for the professors finally accepting it, because it had so much mathematics in it, they thought it was right. Anyways, well, okay, April, May, and now we're through 1905, except for June and September. June is the theory of relativity, and September is E equals MC squared, and that's this afternoon. And then we're going to be done.
Thank you very much, Professor Rigdon. We have time for a few questions. There is an usher on each side of the theater. Please raise your hand and wait for the microphone to come down. We have a question over here, please.
Couple over here, but right up there, right up there.
Thank you, Professor. Very stimulating lecture. I was struck by something, and that is that this issue of statistical violations and irreversibility, life itself is a statistical violation of thermodynamics. And it seems odd to me that physicists would have to go through this kind of mental experiment to prove that thermodynamics, that entropy can be reversed, so to speak, when we ourselves are a manifestation of that and have been so for so long. And
I'll
just add, yes, just a little thing. It speaks to, I'm a former psychiatrist, and speaks to the level of, I don't mean this in a negative sense, but the level of unconsciousness that we as human beings have, and how this unconsciousness actually can block our creativity, and how this can actually be reversed in a sense. It can actually expand our creativity so that we don't have to go to this extreme and maybe advance our ability to understand what's going on here. But thank you very much for your stimulating.
Okay, I'm not quite sure how to respond to the latter part of your question, but the first part, I want to try to show you how you're incorrect. If you look at the human being and isolate the human being, then the second law of thermodynamics is violated, because a human being is going against entropy. I mean, the entropy is decreasing in the human being. But you cannot isolate the human being, because the human being is interacting with the environment in a variety of ways in order to live. You eat corn on the cob, and that corn is highly ordered in nice rows along the cob, and you masticate that corn on the cob, and entropy goes to hell. I mean, it's very disordered and ends up very disordered, and the entropy is increased as a consequence of your eating that corn on the cob. So everything you do in order to live, you interact with your environment in various ways, and if you take the sum of the changes in you, along with the changes that you impose on the environment by the necessity of living, the entropy is increasing. This has been shown in a variety of ways. Now, I'm sorry. So you can't. I would say your problem was that you isolated on just the human. You cannot do that. You have to look at the system. You're not isolated from the larger environment. So I don't know what to do with consciousness, partly because I didn't hear all of your question, but I don't know what to do with it anyways. So somebody over here, yes. Listen, come up afterward if you want, okay? We can chat.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. This is the third time I've heard you now. I just have one question. The coffee and the cream and the entanglement with quantum physics, the chances of that happening are sort of like the coffee and cream, but it can't happen.
Entanglement? I'm sorry, say it again?
The entanglement with
yes.
quantum physics.
Yes.
The coffee and the cream, when the two come back together even though so far apart.
No, they're...
Is that the same thing?
No,
I don't know.
It's not the same thing. No. It's not the same thing. Entanglement, by the way, grows out of Einstein's 1935 paper, the EPR, Einstein-Rosen-Podolsky paper. That paper sat no one looked at it. No one thought anything. They thought he was nuts. And then John Bell at CERN Lab in Switzerland brought that to life. And John Bell created out of that a number of things that vitalized physics and quantum mechanics and brought the focus to the fundamentals of quantum mechanics. And the whole business of entanglement goes right back to Einstein's 1935 paper. And entanglement is just a crazy thing. I mean, that's another subject. But the coffee and cream, as far as I can say, I don't. They're not related. Entanglement is not that.
Hi, Professor Redden. Thank you for your lecture. My question is on the experiment on the Brownian motion. So if the Brownian motion is caused by a randomized bombardment by the atoms, why would there be, on average, overall time that the pollen grain will move from the left to the right? There's a potential of moving from one direction to another direction. In that case, wouldn't it be random?
Well, that's a very nice question. That is a very good question. And by the way, how many have ever heard of the drunkard's walk? You don't say drunkards. You say drunk walk or drunkard's walk. How many have ever heard of this? Well, you know, the drunk comes out of the bar, right? He's really soused. And now, you know, he takes a step this way and then, you know. Well, in perfectly random, probably not true for a drunk, but if it's perfectly random, you can show and predict how far the drunk will be away from the origin, from his starting point in time. You can show that. And the drunkard's walk, the way of analyzing that, goes back to Einstein's Brownian motion paper. So this is a statistical problem which is well understood and so forth. So the drunk actually does get away from the origin, and the pollen particle actually does move. Now, if you wait long enough, the pollen particle will be back probably towards its origin, but you have to wait a while. and so forth. So that's a good question. But I just want people to know that coming out of that paper, the May paper, was a lot of things, such as the way to analyze this random drunk walk. Yes?
Excuse me, just wait for the microphone, please.
Thank you. The slide that you had up about the Brownian motion and showing of how the pollen molecule had moved, the pollen particle.
Yeah.
So did he actually compare, based upon the known size of the pollen particle and the distance through which it had gone, and then how did he use that to compare it to the sugar molecule and was able to compare
no,
the two?
No, he did not do that.
Or how did he arrive at the actual size?
At the size of what?
At the size of the water molecule itself, based upon using
the molecule. The sugar molecule.
Sugar molecule.
All right. What he did for the sugar molecule is he determined, experimentally, you can determine, and the data was available, the viscosity of water alone and the viscosity of water with sugar in it. Two different viscosities. That gave him an equation with two unknowns. One equation, and all of you have had algebra, you know, if you have one equation and two unknown, you're screwed. You can't do it. The two unknowns in the equation were Avogadro's number and the size of the sugar molecule, the radius of the sugar molecule. Those two. Well, you couldn't do it. So what he did next was he introduced a fictitious force. Fictitious, fake. But he had this force act on the sugar molecules to the left. Is that right? To the right. Well, to the right. Had him act on these sugar molecules to the right. And as this happened, the concentration of sugar molecules built up over here, and pretty soon they started diffusing back, the natural diffusion process, because the concentration was high here and low here. And then at equilibrium, these two currents equal each other. You can set them equal to each other. You're pushing them one way, but diffusion's taking back there, and they're equal to each other at equilibrium. So you set the equilibrium, this equals this, and there are two unknowns, the size of the sugar molecule and Avogadro's number. So you had two equations, and the two unknowns, size of the molecule, and he solved it, and Avogadro's number came out very close to what other people had measured. So it was clearly in the ballpark. And the size of the sugar molecule, which was measured later, but it was clearly about what it should be. I mean, it wasn't, 10 feet, and or I should say kilometers or meters, but it was about right. So it was by this means that he determined but what is amazing is what he showed was that the sugar molecule and the pollen particle surrounded by water molecules, that both of these are in equilibrium with the environment. And because they're in equilibrium, he could show that the pollen particle should behave just like a sugar molecule. The only difference being that the sugar molecule would do this, and the pollen particle would do this. It's big, so it's heavier to move around, and it didn't move as rapidly, but basically, the motions were the same. And so the man provided us with a microscope right into the atomic world just by watching this pollen particle and showed how they were connected. I'll tell you, man, that guy was something. I said to the crowd yesterday, and so I'll say it again. Number of polls over the years. The first one I remember was around 1960. Polls taken among physicists. Who were the greatest physicists of all time? And you can guess immediately the top two, Einstein and Newton. Sometimes Einstein is number one, sometimes number two, in individual ballots. But everyone puts those two guys up at the top of all time. Number three is, you would never guess, is Archimedes, 3rd century BC. And so, as I said yesterday, the moral or the lesson is that these kind of people, 3rd century BC, Archimedes, 17th century, Newton, 20th century, Einstein, they come along rarely, you know, once every millennium, once every 800 years. So we could have lived in the 14th century and not seen any of those people. You know, we could have lived in the, but we are fortunate. We are fortunate to have lived at a time when Einstein was a near contemporary of us. And so we see a lot of Einstein's stuff. And he lives with us yet. 50 years he's been dead. Long career. Had his career, had he lived one more day, his career would have been one day longer. He died on Monday morning at 1:10 in the morning, April 18th. And on the night of April 17th, Sunday night, he requested that his writing materials be brought to his hospital room. He wanted to work. And his writing materials were on his bedside stand Monday morning, April 18th, but his hand never reached for them. Okay, any other questions?
One left time for one last question.
Hey, I'm just wondering, two questions actually. One, the first one is with
now speak loudly, I'll tell you. I can't hear worth a darn.
My first question is with regards to your beginning slides when he talks about, when Einstein was mentioning he's trying to look into the thoughts of God.
Yes.
And I've read contradictory opinions of whether or not he was making a statement as to his belief in God at that point. So I'm just wondering what your opinion was. Was he making a statement or was it symbolic?
Okay.
My second question, if I can have A and B,
yep.
Is with regards to when you mention that today string theorists are not tying it to observable experiments. Is that, in your opinion, primarily due to the lack of ability to see string phenomena yet? With the current stuff that we have?
Okay, first question. No, let me take the second question first, then I'll come back to the first question. No, the string theorists are not do not lack an ability. It's a very tough problem. Look, one of the big questions of humans ever since, what are the basic building blocks of matter? What's his face in the Ionian 6th century BC, Thales of Miletus said everything was water. Underlying everything, it's water. Think of that. Think of the mental leap that represents when somebody says everything is water. It wasn't true, but God, what a step. And then it became, you know, earth, water, air, fire, and was that for centuries. Those were the four basic elements. That's what fundamental, that was what matter was. Well, we're still on that track, and string theory is right there at the frontier. It's a very tough game. The thing I wish physicists would be, physicists are caught up with formalism. They love mathematics, and the string theory is highly elegant mathematics. And I don't think, In my judgment, but you know, there are people upstairs who would probably kick me in the rear. I don't think contemporary physicists are as determined as Einstein was to touch Earth with his big ideas and to make sure you could experimentally test those big ideas. He was, and earlier in physics, I think it was a more driving concern than it is in today. They're still struggling with it. All right, God. Einstein was very adamant on two points. A, he was not an atheist, whatever that means. B, he did not believe in a personal God. He said that time and time again. But whether there was a God behind the laws of nature, whether there was a God in that sense, he saw in the harmony of nature and in the beauty of the laws of nature and the way that they come together, that for him was sort of evidence of something beyond. I mean, he talks in that way. But as far as his having personal contact with a divine. He did not and did not think that was possible. So it's a little bit difficult to do. But God was a metaphor in his work. I mean, it was a prominent way that influenced his work. Let me just say, I wrote a biography of Robbie. Robbie was a great physicist. And when he was doing a good experiment, he was walking the path of God. And when he was doing a tough experiment, he was wrestling with the champ. And when he saw his students years later, and the students would come up and say, you know, here's what I'm, he would say, what are you doing? And they would describe what they're doing. And Robbie would say, does it bring you near to God? And what he meant was, is it important? Is that work really important? If it's really important, then this metaphor is so useful. Does it bring you near to God? And Robbie would say, they knew what I meant. So God in the mind of a few great physicists is a powerful metaphor of doing great physics. You're doing God's work. You're walking the path of God. You're getting God's thoughts or whatever. Okay?
Ladies. Before you go, a reminder that Professor Rigdon has a lecture at 2 o'clock, the June and September papers. We always do have cancellations. If you would like to come to that lecture and do not have a ticket, please see the people at our ticket office out front. Also like to tell you that Professor Rigdon's book, 1905, The Standard of Greatness, is for sale at the exit. I'm going to ask you to exit upstairs to the right. And also a reminder of Bistro Banter this afternoon with Howard Burton, John Rigdon, and Stephen Kern. Again, John, thank you very much for a great lecture.
And I want you, some of you that are coming this afternoon, be prepared to carry me out.